From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross. On this edition of Fresh Air, tales of two ordinary men who undergo extraordinary transformation. Before he walked into a local gym, Sam Fussell was a gawky, skinny-looking guy. 4 years later, he was a champion bodybuilder who had not just altered his appearance, but his psyche as well. We'll talk with Sam Fussell. The main character in Robert Bausch's new novel undergoes the ultimate transformation. He gains the power of God. Coming up, Robert Bausch talks about God in his novel and in his life. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from pianist Dave McKenna. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Islamic Jihad, the pro-Iranian group holding hostages in Lebanon, says it will free its hostages in 24 hours if Islamic fighters imprisoned in the Middle East and Europe are also released. The offer comes in a letter to the UN Secretary General, hand-delivered yesterday by the released British hostage John McCarthy. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
The United Nations released the Islamic Jihad's letter today in Geneva, where the UN Secretary General Javier Pérez de Cuellar was discussing arrangements for the release of the remaining Western hostages. While in Geneva, Pérez de Cuellar met with a representative of the Israeli government, Yuri Lubrani, who has negotiated previous hostage releases. The Islamic Jihad, in their letter, specifically say they want freedom for Lebanese and Palestinians being held by Israel and by its ally, the South Lebanon Army. Pérez de Cuellar said the concrete offer by the Islamic Jihad made him feel more hopeful that a solution to the hostage problem might now be found. Meanwhile, released American hostage Edward Tracy today enjoyed his first full day of freedom in almost 5 years. He's staying at an Air Force hospital in Wiesbaden, Germany, while undergoing medical and psychological examinations. In Wiesbaden, I'm Tom Gelton.
The United Nations announced today that it's using a high-altitude spy plane to monitor Iraq's compliance with the weapons provisions of the UN ceasefire agreement. The move appeared to be designed to make sure that Iraq doesn't make any further attempts to move nuclear materials in order to hide them from inspectors. The UN's chief ballistics inspector said today that Iraq appears to be cooperating with his team. Wolfgang Butler said that his inspectors were shown a giant Iraqi cannon yesterday. He said the so-called supergun was assembled but not operational. The United Nations Secretary General is recommending a reduction in the size of the UN's military observer mission monitoring the Kuwait-Iraq border. Linda Fasulo reports.
Just 4 months after the UN's observer mission was authorized under ceasefire terms, its chief military observer has recommended to the Secretary General that the operation be scaled down. Major General Grindel reports that the situation in the demilitarized zone is calm and that border violations and incidents have decreased. He suggests that the number of infantry be reduced from 300 to 250 and that medical and logistical units be cut as well. The biggest cut is to be in the reduction of engineers from nearly 300 to 85. But eventually, the military mission is expected to be reduced by 45%. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 5 points to close at 3,001.34. Advances edge declines in moderate trading of 145 million shares. This is NPR News. U.S. customs officials said today that one of the four men arrested last week in a weapons-buying sting has been linked to a Croatian nationalist group. The men were arrested after they tried to buy Stinger missiles, rifles, and other weapons from undercover agents in Miami. Customs Commissioner Carol Hallett said that the men offered a down payment of $10,000 on what they believed would be a shipment of weapons worth $12 million. She said that one man, identified as a U.S. citizen living in Chicago, had links to a terrorist group thought to be part of the Croatian National Resistance. Hallett said the group is believed to have funded its arms purchases by extorting money from wealthy Croatians living in the United States. A report released today by the Children's Defense Fund says the District of Columbia has the country's highest infant mortality rate, while Vermont has the lowest. Maeve McGoran has more.
Citing data gathered by the National Center for Health Statistics, the report says more than 2% of the babies born in Washington, D.C. in 1988 died before their first birthdays. The District of Columbia's infant mortality rate was higher than that of any other big city, as well as all 50 states. The lowest infant mortality rates were in Vermont and Hawaii. The nation's capital also led the country in the percentage of low birth weight babies, as well as single mothers, while New Mexico had the poorest record of prenatal care. Across the country, the report found the mortality rate for black babies more than twice as high as for whites. I'm Maeve McGoran in Washington.
A federal judge in Wichita, Kansas, freed four abortion protesters after finding one guilty of contempt for blocking the entrance to a women's health clinic that performs abortions. One of the men was released after promising not to violate the order again, and the judge said there wasn't enough evidence to find the others, including two Roman Catholic priests, guilty of contempt. Eight other protesters still face possible contempt charges. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Sam Fussell was a short, skinny kid who, when adolescence hit, became a tall and skinny teenager. He was a bookish student. He graduated with honors from Oxford University with a degree in English literature. His parents are intellectuals. His father, Paul Fussell, is a noted literary critic, and his mother, Betty Fussell, is a writer. Sam Fussell grew up in a world that valued intellect over athletics. When he graduated from college and left the protected walls of academia, he moved to New York City and became consumed by his fears of urban life. What he did to make himself feel invulnerable was become a bodybuilder. He spent 4 years, 4 hours a day, 6 days a week, pumping iron. He turned himself into a larger-than-life muscle man and nearly killed himself in the process. Fussell's written a memoir about those obsessive years called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder. When we spoke, I asked him what made him so unlikely.
How many 6'4", 250-pound, Oxford-educated, steroid-addicted bodybuilders do you know who live next door?
And is it the brains and the brawn? I mean, is that what makes you different from bodybuilders?
Well, I am not that different from bodybuilders. I think most bodybuilders even aren't that different from most other human beings. People regard bodybuilding as a subject so extreme, so irrational, that they have no clue why anyone would do that. But if you think about it, it's really not that irrational at all. Bodybuilding is about embracing a so-called lifestyle, in which we all do as human beings. The clothes you wear, the furniture you buy for your apartment, the house you drive, the home you buy or the apartment you buy, they're all emblems of the self. Who but a bodybuilder knows about projecting that self and foisting it upon the rest of the world?
Well, reading your book, and I understand exactly what you're saying, but at the same time, the extreme obsession, and you really write about the obsession of bodybuilding, I think does make it slightly different than other people who are as egocentric and narcissistic as everybody else. But this obsession and this focus on body is different.
The focus on body is different. I don't think the obsession's different. Take a man who makes money. Money and muscles, very similar. Two incremental self-measures of worth. In bodybuilding, the difference is that your body is everything. Mm-hmm. In money, it's not everything. It becomes, in a man's obsession or a woman's obsession for it, it can become everything. But in bodybuilding, it's all body.
Is there any way to be a bodybuilder and not be obsessed about it?
Not an incredibly successful one, no. On the other hand, if you want to be Donald Trump, don't expect to have a nice home life. Mm-hmm. Huge sacrifices have to be made if you're going to be successful at just about anything.
You talk about it, or other people talk about it, and this is kind of in the beginning of your career as a bodybuilder, the disease. I mean, that's the phrase you use. Why?
The disease I call a complete commitment to all matters pertaining to iron, not just lifting weights, but reading about them. The food you eat, it's all bodybuilding food, protein powders, amino packs. The hours you sleep, you have to get 10 or 12 good hours a night. The jobs you take, you work as a personal trainer in order to work out in the morning, work out at night. It's all emblems of the disease.
Did you feel when you were bodybuilding that you had a disease, or did you have another way of explaining
it? Oh, absolutely I felt I had a disease. People don't realize that much about bodybuilding is camp. It is artifice raised to an amazing extreme so that bodybuilders chuckle at themselves. Most of the best bodybuilders in the world realize, on the one hand, they've developed a carapace of armor, which is really menacing to other human beings. On the other hand, many of the best ones realize this is absurd. It's a hilarious parody of what it means to be a man. But as long as that's it, let's play with it.
You say that you, after graduating from Oxford University, moved to New York City, found yourself really frightened. I mean, frightened by the city. What do you think was so scary?
I felt absolutely under siege. I felt absolutely out of control. For 7 years I'd been at college, and every day all I did was read and study, and that's what I loved. I was sequestered in a little lonely room, and I was absolutely rewarded for it academically. As soon as I came out of college and decided, well, I don't really know if I want to become a college professor or not, I was in New York City, I was working at a job I didn't particularly like, and I no longer had any emblems of status. I didn't have any money, I had a sublet apartment. I had nothing, I felt, including no self-control.
You describe yourself, you're tall, and you were always had been a kind of skinny, tall
kid.
Yeah,
Tony Perkins lookalike.
What made you think, and you really talk about seeing a picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's interesting to me that you hadn't seen pictures of bodybuilders before, but there was something, even a moment, in a bookstore where you said, that's my solution. That's the solution to my problem.
I did think that. I looked at that kind of body, and I thought, what could possibly perturb this man? Here are muscles in the shape of mountains on that body. His biceps are biceps, true, but they're also bulging Mount Everest biceps. First of all, how does a guy like that buy clothes? That was an immediate interest. Right. And then second of all, how could a guy like that possibly be hurt by anything or anyone? How could someone like that feel humiliated if his girlfriend told him, God, I really don't like you very much? Would he cry? I don't think so. Not the kind of Arnold I projected.
So you were seeing the muscles as a kind of suit of armor. Interesting, both against the kind of physical world, but also against the hurts of the emotional
Certainly.
World.
Certainly. Think of a lobster's carapace. There's a great red lobster, and he's formed by medieval armor. I wanted something which was absolutely impermeable, which would not let other people touch me. I wanted to be, let's use a cartoon image for mm-hmm. a cartoon world. I wanted mm-hmm. to be a fortress of solitude. I wanted Superman's private preserve, where I could impress everyone a great deal, but inside not be touched.
Tell us about the first time you went into a weight room. What did you see?
I saw a great dichotomy, a split right down the middle of the room. On the one side of the room were the men, most of them scrawny number two pencil necks, who used the universal weight machines and the Nautilus machines. On the other side were the free weight sector group, a rowdy, absolute camouflage-wearing band of men who wore T-shirts that said things like, don't bark if you can't growl.
Was there anything enjoyable about that first day?
The enjoyable thing was I started. I'd done it. It's like a boxer finally getting into the ring. Okay, like the first day of school. Great trepidation involved, but finally you've done it.
Well, I'll say that my small smile here is just that when I walk by a Nautilus room at a you know, an aerobics place, and I see people, men and women, sweating out there, I look in and I say, I don't understand. I don't understand the attraction. I don't understand what brings these people to this room over and over and over again.
One of the reasons is sex. If you don't like to go to bars, you can go to gyms and you can find people who you might well want to take home and make love with.
Although you describe in your years of building yourself up that you actually didn't have a lot of girlfriends. I mean, it seemed as if sex took a real backseat to your own body. I guess your own body was more important than another person's body.
It was. I tell people that my process in the gym was a matter of de-evolution. I started off as just simple Sam, who I am. That then changed to Samson. Took about 30 pounds in 2 years. I became Samson, who was muscle man. Mm. Samson was okay for about 2 years more, 30 more pounds, till I was about 240. Then I was Samosaurus, a half-man, half-dinosaur hybrid. From there, I finally became a He-Man Masters of the Universe life-action doll, and I was recognized as such by school children on a playground. I was tanning before my last contest. They came up to me. I heard whispering above me. My eyes were closed. I felt the sun on my back, and then I heard the word, Skeletor! He's Skeletor! As if I was a life-action doll. I became a He-Man doll in such a way that the only women eventually I was interested in dating were she-women, ditzy, girly-girl equivalents of my masculine image.
You actually have a funny but sort of a sad scene of yourself and a woman bodybuilder whose name just escaped me. You can say
G-spot. G-spot. Are we allowed to say that on the air?
How could I have forgotten? Where you actually, we don't need to get too graphic here, but tried to make love with her, and it was as if, and it was a pretty funny description about these two, I guess she people, trying to embrace. I mean, it was almost like, you know, iron lip against iron lip.
Yeah, think of the Monitor and the Merrimack during the Civil War, two great ironclad vessels that were very much about menace and not much about anything else. We embraced, I kissed her and found a mustache hairier than my own.
You talk about the kind of simplicity of building your body up. Not that it doesn't take a long time and there isn't a lot of discipline involved, but there is this kind of cause and effect. I mean, if you do this, then you're going to get some muscles where you want them. Were you attracted to that? And you mentioned the control, the idea that you could go into this room and for once be in some control over your life.
I loved it. I loved the fact that not only was it about reinvention as a human being, but it was also about something which you don't often find in the workplace. In the workplace, you can be very diligent, very industrious, and work 75-hour weeks and be incredibly competent at your job, but it doesn't guarantee promotion. Your boss might not like you or might be sleeping with someone who's working with you who's incompetent and promote them. The gym isn't like that. You put in the time, you eat right, you diet properly, you put in your hours, you get stronger, and you get bigger. It absolutely works.
It was interesting, and I was reading an article, I think, that your mother wrote about you as you were building your body up, and this was an article in Lear's magazine, and she said that the larger you got, the smaller that she felt. What effect did this have on your parents, who I will add are both, college professors, considered to be part of the intellectual crowd, we can say that?
Well, on one hand, my mother was disgusted. I remember submitting my tape of Pumping Iron, the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, to her, and she said, "This is disgusting of these men. These men have tits." And I tried to explain to her mother, this is physical development. She said, "Yes, and meanwhile, they're functionally illiterate." So she hated that side of it, and she thought that I was becoming a beast. But
this gets back to your idea about growing up in an intellectual family. It seems that bodybuilding would be the opposite of what your family wanted for you.
It was, but I always realized that I could do something in bodybuilding. I also knew that Hunter Thompson had written a book called Hell's Angels, which I loved, and I knew that no one had written a book on bodybuilding and that I could do it. I knew I'd have to live it, but that was fine because I loved living it. I thought, okay, if I bodybuild for the next 50 years, I'm never going to stop writing books. I'll always be able to get books out of it.
Sam Fussell is my guest. His book about his 4-year obsession with bodybuilding is called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Samuel Wilson Fussell, and he's just written a book called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder, and it's about his years building up his body and the people he met, the experiences he had, and some of the psychological involvements with this whole process that he went through. As you were building up your body, tell us what your life was like. I mean, how did you spend your day? And I guess we're still in New York now.
In New York, I started still holding a job. I thought I was naive enough to believe that I was capable of holding a 9-to-5 job and work out as a bodybuilder. That soon changed. The demands are very high, and I realized that after about 6 months of not getting any sleep, that I had to choose. People become Mr. Olympias not by holding down full-time jobs, but by becoming full-time bodybuilders. So immediately I realized after the first few months I would have to eat differently, and that included 5,000 to 7,500 calories a day. It included 10 raw eggs a day. It included all kinds of chicken breasts, pounds of meat. Unbelievable.
And that's expensive. I mean, if you're going to...
It is expensive. That's why you don't have girlfriends when you do it, because you can't afford to take them out on dates.
Well, how much would you spend a week on food? I mean,
I'd say about $200 a week. For an individual person. And then if you're making, as I was at, I won't say where, $13,000 a year, you can't afford anything else other than your rent.
So how do you support yourself?
Then you become a personal trainer. You move to California and train the wacky and the weird, which is just what I did.
You talk about the walk, I mean, yeah. The bodybuilder's walk. And I think we know what that looks like, those of us that have seen bodybuilders. How did your attitude or even your persona change? How did you become this person you were inventing for yourself?
Yeah, it's a very complex question. It gets down to Norman Mailer's Advertisements for Myself. I learned the walk from my two friends, gym friends, Sweepy and Mousy, and I realized from the beginning it was a fantastic way to become living theater, to be animated motion of what it means to be menacing.
And for people that aren't familiar with the walk, how would you describe it?
I would describe it as that particular weightlifter's waddle known among the bodybuilding cognoscenti. The thighs are flared outward to prevent inner thighs chafing because the thighs are so big.
Right.
The arms are swept way out to the side because the massivity of your lats or your back necessitates, presumably in theory, that your elbows be as high up as your shoulders. So you look like an enormous turkey with his breast way out strutting as a peacock around the world.
You also look like, and I'm not trying to insult you here, but you look like a pinhead. I mean, the odd thing I find about bodybuilders is that the body gets built up, but you can't add to the head.
Oh, and bodybuilders love that. They want their head to look absolutely tiny. I was actually called in the gym Zippy the Pinhead because my shoulders got so big, my head looked like a pea balanced on the middle of a ruler.
But why? I mean, what's
because
beautiful
this isn't this isn't about the glorification of the head or the mind. This is about head decapitation. If you want to look like the Belvedere Apollo, you don't care what's above the neck. You just care what's down. Bodybuilders, many of them pride themselves in not being so good looking. Lots of people can inherit cheekbones. Very few people can make muscles. That's the way they view it.
How easy was it to get steroids?
It was as easy as asking. But steroids are an enormous controversy right now, and unfortunately, steroids are here to stay. The problem now is that we've developed for ourselves a ludicrous situation in which everyone is forced to lie. The competitors are forced to risk their health, and everyone else profits other than some of the competitors. Take in track and field a meat promoter. The meat promoter wants to make money. To make money, you want world records set, or else you're not going to get a full house. To set world records, it helps for the athletes to take every advantage they can in order to get those world records, which have been broken on steroids anyway. So it's a huge vicious cycle.
Where did steroids take you?
Steroids took me faster than I would have gone without them. They got me what I wanted. What I wanted to do was to compete and to become a bodybuilder and do it as fast as possible. It took me 4 years to look like one of the guys in the magazines. It takes most people 8 or 10 years.
Were you getting double doses?
I was getting... there are no double doses because there's no norm. If you're alive and you're taking steroids, you're succeeding. That's the way the bodybuilding people think it. If your system's capable of taking it, then keep on taking it. It's amazing how much people pack it in.
And the side effects? How did you deal with those?
The side effects I had were acne. I did have a ton of that. I did have rectal bleeding. I had tons of nosebleeds. But the thing about steroids is there are no guarantees. There are thousands of people who have taken them with seemingly no side effects, or side effects like acne, which they view as something purely temporary. The side effects I had were purely temporary. When I went off, the side effects went off.
It's interesting to me that you wanted to build your body up, and yet you didn't mind it covered with acne. I don't want to get obsessed on this, but that's an interesting...
I'll tell you why.
Okay.
When you bodybuild and you are covered with acne, you don't see it on stage because you buy for $25 a quart, you buy gallon jugs of fake tan. As long as you cover yourself with this veneer, the judges can't see the acne. The only people you really want to care about you are the judges in the bodybuilding shows. Providing you look... You can look like Moby Dick off-season, being a tremendous fat man. But you might not care for 90 seconds a year when you're on stage, the judges don't see you as a fat man.
My guest is Samuel Fussell. His book is called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder. It's about his years building up his body and the world of bodybuilding, and also for him, some of the psychological issues that he was struggling with as he was creating this, as you say, this kind of suit of armor for yourself. Was the goal, then, of all this to compete? I mean, is that the goal? That was the goal for you from the beginning?
Yeah. Arnold Schwarzenegger had won Mr. Universe in 5 years. Yeah. I thought, okay, if he's done it in 5 years, if I work as hard as anyone who's ever worked at this, why can't I do it in 5 or maybe 4? And by the time I'd done 4, the next year I would have done the Mr. America show, and the logical sequence from that is doing the Mr. Universe show. And I realized after my 4th year, forget it. If this is what it means to do it, I don't want it. I want to be a human being. I don't want to be superhuman.
Well, how did your routine change as you then went into competition?
It's called the contest countdown, where you break down everything in the day in order to win in a contest. So my diet changed from going from 7,500 calories a day to just 1,000 calories a day. For a 260-pound man, 1,000 calories a day or 750 calories a day is a matter of rice cakes and water. That's eating almost nothing.
So your body's starting to eat itself.
Oh, that's the whole point. It does eat itself. But providing it eats its fat first and not its muscle, then you're fine on stage. The problem, once you're on stage, stage is that you have so little energy left that while you're swiveling and growling and preening and posing, you're about to collapse and black out because you're so dizzy. But the point isn't to be healthy inside. It's to look like the image of self-health to the judges. It's also about to look like you're in control.
At one point, and this is really at the very end of your career, you got your, I guess you were eating about 630 calories a day. I mean, this was sort of training for the big event.
Yeah.
And you could hardly even make it to the event. I mean, you were so
weak. I could literally not even walk. I did two contests in 2 weeks. There was a one-week break between each. In the first contest, I was about 8 pounds overweight, and I realized it on stage. I won the show. I won my weight class, but I was a little hefty. And in bodybuilding circles, they call it smoother than a glass mirror. Mm. You couldn't see enough veins, the vascularity look that's prized among bodybuilders. So I realized I needed to lose at least 8 to 10 pounds. So in 6 days, I lost 12 pounds. And I did that by sitting on the sofa or lying down on the sofa, practically comatose, and not eating a great deal, eating almost all down to 500 calories a day. I was so weak, I couldn't even practice my posing. I couldn't get up. I didn't go to the bathroom for the whole week because my body was feeding on itself.
Do you think you were losing your mind?
No, I think I was doing exactly what I wanted to do. And that's what it took to do it. For people to think that bodybuilders don't do that, bodybuilders are lying when they say they don't do that because they're trying to sell their product to the public. They're trying to say, oh, this is great. It's about health. Ha!
And where did your muscles go? You still have some. I mean, I can see that.
They atrophied. And another muscle cliche, you don't lose it, you lose it. Mm. And the hard part is if you've been evolving and you see yourself evolving from a 17-inch collar to an 18 to a 20, all of a sudden you go back down to an 18 to a 17 and you're wearing the same shirts you were wearing 5 or 6 years ago. The trick is thinking, gosh, I hope I'm not the same person I was 6 years ago. And you're not. But if you just lead your life according to measurements and inches, then that's where you're always going to be. It's an endless rut.
I'm curious where then the pain that drove you to this sense of feeling afraid in the world, of feeling vulnerable, what happened to that?
I decided to face it.
Did you?
I got so tired of erecting the proscenium and the facade. It was Baroque. It was Rococo. It was so complex. It was such stage scenery. I spent so many hours per day hoisting it and working the ratchets and the levers. I didn't want to do it anymore. I'd much rather just face it. If it means having to be humiliated and having to bear insults, fine. I'm willing to do that. Just don't force me to go to the weight room and make me mouth the cliches and look like Superman. Don't want to do that anymore.
And you still work out some?
I won't work out for 6 months at a time. If I have to let off some steam, I'll go in, renew old acquaintances, and do a few times a week. But I'm no longer a prisoner to it, thank God. And I love those who do. I love to watch it. I just don't want to be one of them anymore.
Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Sam Fussell's book is called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Looking. What you got cooking? How's about cooking something up with me? Hey, sweet baby, don't you think maybe we could find us a brand new recipe? I got a brand new car and a $2 bill, yeah. Know a spot right over the hill. That's soda pop and the dancing free. So if you wanna have fun, along with me. So hey, good looking, what you got cooking? How's about cooking something up with me?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. I'm filling in for Terry Gross, who's on vacation. What would you do if you could do anything? What would you do if you were given the power of God? In Robert Bausch's new novel, Almighty Me, used car salesman Charlie Wiggins gains those powers and discovers that even when you have the power to do anything, life just isn't that easy. Coming up, we talk with Robert Bausch. Dave McKenna's fans have been known to travel hundreds of miles just to hear him play background piano in a hotel bar. McKenna's latest album is just out, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us whether it's worth traveling to your local record store to get it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A letter from kidnappers in Lebanon offers to trade all Western hostages for what they termed all detainees around the world. The letter carried by former hostage John McCarthy did not mention seven missing Israeli soldiers. The UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar said after reading the letter that while he could not say that the crisis is about to end, an end appears nearer than before. Jim Muir, the BBC, has more.
While the Beirut kidnappers have signaled that they're interested in ending the long chapter of the Western hostages, their letter makes it clear that many problems remain to be resolved. It contained no reference at all to the seven Israeli servicemen missing in Lebanon, some of them captured by Shiite radicals. The Israelis were hoping for some word on the fate of the missing seven, and were disappointed. They've made it clear that until they do get information, there will be no negotiations on an exchange with the Lebanese Shiites. Another obvious problem is the letter's demand for the release of Islamic militants in European as well as Israeli prisons. Previous efforts by Beirut kidnappers to use hostages to gain the release of comrades imprisoned in Europe have failed, notably in the case of the Hamadi brothers jailed in Germany on terrorist charges.
Jim Muir, the BBC, in Nicosia. Reports out of Lebanon that the Iranian-backed Hezbollah is willing to allow the International Red Cross to visit Israelis being held prisoner if Israel allows the Red Cross to visit Lebanese prisoners. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem.
Sheikh Abdul Karim Obeid, the Shiite Muslim cleric kidnapped by Israeli commandos in 1989, is the most well-known of some 400 Lebanese being held in Israel or by the Israeli-backed South Lebanese army. At the time of his abduction, it was hoped Obeid could serve as a bargaining chip to get back Israeli servicemen being held by Shiite groups. Israel is still waiting for news of the seven who went missing or were captured in Lebanon during and since the 1982 war in Lebanon. The International Red Cross has admitted it has no idea where they are being held. If this latest report permitting Red Cross visits is not just a rumor, it could be a breakthrough. Defense Minister Aaron said he regretted hints by Western leaders that Israel should release Arab prisoners before getting word on its servicemen. Nobody can expect us to abandon our soldiers, he said. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
French newspapers are reporting that the United States and Britain held secret talks in Paris recently with members of the Hezbollah party in efforts to get Western hostages set free. According to one newspaper report, an agreement may have been worked out and a schedule set for the release of prisoners. The paper said the release of John McCarthy last week and Edward Tracy over the weekend came in the context of that alleged agreement. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 5 points to close at 3,001.34, volume 145 million shares. This is NPR News. North Korea has called off talks on a proposal to send a unified team to the 1992 Olympics after a sports defection to the South. North Korea also warned that a meeting between South and North Korean prime ministers later on this month will be seriously affected if two college students on an unofficial visit to the North are arrested when they return home. A new report in this country that ranks states for their encouragement of a healthy environment has placed Oregon at the top of the list. A so-called Green Index, compiled by the Institute of Southern Studies, indicates Alabama has the worst environmental record. Alan Saporin of member station KLCC has more.
Maine, Vermont, and California joined Oregon near the top of the chart. While the South as a whole rated very low, Texas, Mississippi, and Arkansas were all near the bottom. The study determined that California has the strictest environmental laws in the country, with Oregon second. But Oregon was rated number one overall because of its recycling programs and relatively low acid levels in rainfall. The state received low marks for oil spills and forest preservation. Bob Hall, co-author of the study, says Oregonians believe natural resources should contribute to the quality of life as well as the economy. Hall says the main purpose of the study is to send a message of urgency to low-ranking states. Critics say the Green Index is subjective and uses outdated information. For National Public Radio, this is Alan Saporin in Eugene.
In Venezuela, thousands of transportation workers are on strike in protest of higher gasoline prices. A union spokesman says in many outlying cities, public transportation has been brought to a standstill. However, in the capital, subway and bus service continued after workers voted not to strike. Those workers are now under police protection. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We've all had fantasies of playing God at some time. Imagine what you would do if you had the chance. That's the plot of Robert Bausch's comic novel, Almighty Me. The main character, Charlie Wiggins, is a car salesman who one day receives notice that God's power has been bestowed upon him for 1 year. What follows is the story of Charlie's struggle with power and its limitations. Here's Robert Bausch reading from the opening of Almighty Me.
One cold night in November 3 years ago, I was a normal person opening his mail. I was a very normal person. It was November 7th, a Tuesday. I don't see any reason why I should try to be modest about this. I was a very kind, nice sort of person. I never harmed anyone on purpose. I tried to smile all the time at old people, and I was patient with other people's children. I paid my bills on time, contributed to the National Arbor Day Foundation, Greenpeace, and Jerry's Kids. I believed in God. But I was not who I am now. I did not think I would ever write this story, but at the end of that winter 3 years ago, the winter that began with that cold November evening when I first opened Chet's letter and discovered I had been awarded the power of God for one full year, no strings attached, I made a momentous decision which has required that I set down this narrative. At present, I see what I will write as the first step in a final attempt to break a terrible stalemate, a paralyzing standoff between myself and God. The decision I spoke of was the most significant of my whole life. In truth, it may be epical for just about everybody.
Where did this idea come from? This idea of having the power of God for a year. The power, but not the knowledge.
It began with a conversation I had with my brother-in-law, who's a poet. His name is Gregory Natt, and we go to Canada fishing every year. And we were sitting in this fishing camp, and, you know, as things will, when you're sitting around talking and smoking and drinking, the talk is fun, and it goes wide-ranging.
Yeah.
And at one point, I just happened to ask whether or not Christ trimmed his beard. It seemed to me that every picture I've ever seen, a representation I've seen of the Lord, his beard is perfectly trimmed, and he was, after all, God, and he did have the power to do anything he wanted. I mean, if since he was God, he had to know that air conditioning was 2,000 years hence, and maybe on a real hot day in the desert, no one was around. Who would it have hurt if he just, you know, gave himself a little perk there? I mean, he was human, after all. And I didn't think it was irreverent to ask the question. I just wondered, why would he go through all that trouble of trimming his beard when he could very easily just sort of, when no one was looking, snap his fingers and it would be trimmed? And that got me thinking of what would happen if you gave an ordinary human being God's power and not his wisdom. What would he do?
And you picked a car salesman as the embodiment of at least God for a year on earth. Why a salesman?
Well,
or car salesman, actually.
I sold cars for a while when I got out of the service. I knew the business well. I wanted him to be somebody who was working with people every day, and I'm glad that he was turned out to be selling a big-ticket item. But I really discovered he was a car salesman while I was writing it. It wasn't anything I planned. I had to give him a job, and I was writing the sentence, and I wrote car salesman knowing, as every writer knows when he writes a sentence, that might change. But as I began to build on it, it became more and more solid, and then I just left it that way.
Well, I wonder, having never been a car saleswoman, whether there's something that a car salesman has to do. You have to be better than yourself. You have to be patient. You have to be long-suffering. You have to be all these good qualities to make the sale.
Mm-hmm. And you have to be friendly, and you have to be... You really do. I mean, I did it for a year, but I learned a lot in doing it. You really do have to begin to care about the people you're working with. I mean, the people can sense right away when a car salesman or any person they're working with really doesn't care about them and cares more about themselves. The salesmen who come on with the glitzy attitude and the greasy look don't succeed because they can't really care about the people they're dealing with.
And but, people know that, right?
Right. Yeah, they sense it. That's why people are scared when a car salesman comes up to them, because they're afraid they're going to have to make the commitment of caring about this person or seeing that this person doesn't care about them. It's not that they're afraid the salesman is going to somehow hypnotize them and make them buy a red car. It's that there's that relationship between a salesman and a person that people don't want unless they're certain they want to buy something, because they don't like to say no to somebody they come to like. And most of the salesmen I've known who were successful salesmen were really good people. Oh. They told great stories. They were funny. They were enlightened. They thought about a lot of things other than tickets and prices on cars.
Were you a good salesman, car salesman?
Yeah.
Did you have
for
those qualities?
I was a young man then, and my father was a car salesman all his life, and I felt so proud of myself for doing something my father was so successful at. My father was a really good salesman. He had most of his friends were customers, people who bought cars from him. He made relationships with people work, and I was proud to be doing that. I didn't succeed to the point where I thought I could make a career out of it, but I did learn a lot. People don't buy a car in a gloomy mood. Most people who buy cars, almost all the time, they're in a real good mood. And when you deliver a car, it's a real good experience. It's almost like what it must be like to perform weddings. I mean, that's a ceremony. People come to get a new car. They're real happy about that.
My guest is novelist Robert Bausch. His new book is called Almighty Me. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Novelist Robert Bausch is my guest. Do you think of yourself as a religious man?
I think of myself as a committed man.
Committed to what?
My work, my family. When I say my work, I mean my teaching. I think about moral questions a lot, about what's right and what's wrong, because I was raised Catholic, and Catholic upbringing is very clear about that. I mean, there was a good reason why priests and nuns wear black and white. The Catholic vision of the world, at least when I was growing up, was black and white. It's either good or it's not. And there wasn't really, the in-between they tried to give you was venial. They said this is venial, but they didn't know the difference between real evil and I don't know, their idea of what evil is. I mean, you know, when I was a boy, it was a mortal sin to eat meat on a Friday, to eat a piece of deviled ham on a Friday was just as bad as barbecuing a child. And that vision, when I was that age, I was incomprehensible to me. Even as a young boy, it didn't seem to me that those two things were equal.
Do you think having this kind of Catholic upbringing gave you a structure, at least to ponder some of these questions, whether in the end you believed them or you didn't believe them? But I most of the Catholics that I know carry, whether they still go to church, whether they still believe anything, they carry this Catholicism with them. It's impossible to shed it.
I'm not Catholic anymore, but my body is. You know, there's a part of my psyche that will never give that up. I mean, when I have a significant desire or anxiety, I do things to try to do what I call is charming the fates. But really what I'm doing is a significant form of Catholic prayer, is praying for guidance, asking for or hoping, you know, what are you doing when you're hoping? Right. You're speaking to something outside yourself. So there, intellectually, I find it sometimes very difficult to accept what I think is fairly selfish Christian notion about God being personally involved with me. And I, as a teacher, I've seen how that operates, and that seemed to me to be more selfish than people realize.
Well, I wondered, too, about the phrases people use if they survive an accident, they say, thank God. And I wonder, then, reversing that, you look at, for instance, at what happens in Bangladesh or Ethiopia or Sudan, God has picked those people to kill them?
You know, the best example I can think of that is I had a class, a creative writing class, and I had a student who was writing a story about the miracle of the shoes. It was a true story. And unbeknownst to her, there was another student in the class who was working every day with me and with her counselors and with her priest and with everyone she knew to get her daughter to come to accept the fact that she was going to be dead within the year of leukemia. They were working with her and praying with her, and at the same time she was praying to God to bring this young girl back. And these were sweet, good people. And
This other woman was a very sweet, good woman, too, and she's turning in this story about praying to find her daughter's shoes on her first day of school and how really important it was and how the morning was all upset and turned over and everything was in disarray, and she'd looked in a closet and they weren't there. And then she said, knelt down and said this prayer to God, "Please help me find my daughter's shoes." And she found the shoes and thanked God, and she called that a miracle. And I kept looking at the woman whose daughter was dying and who was a good and faithful person who didn't deserve what was happening to her. And her daughter certainly didn't. Her daughter was only 6 years old. And her prayers every day not being answered, and this person talking about a miracle of shoes, seemed to me to be so profoundly selfish as to be not expressible. There was no way that she could understand how selfish it was and self-centered it was to think that God would intervene in her life to find those shoes and would leave this other woman's misery to herself. I like what my friend George Garrett says. He's a great writer, and one of the things he talks about, he's a very religious man, more religious than I am, and he says, God has never been very interested in persons. And I think that's true.
You have a twin brother.
Right.
An identical twin brother?
Yes, looks exactly like me.
It looks so. You could have been your twin brother. You could have tricked me here and come here as your brother.
No, I wouldn't do that, although we have done that. We did that in high school.
Well, I was wondering whether if you look exactly like somebody else and people do confuse you with that other person, whether that ever gave you a kind of confused identity, if you were called by your brother's name a lot of the time or half the time.
What it did is it made me want to establish at a very early age my identity and made me more conscious of it. I remember we were in the fifth grade. We were at a school called Weller Road Elementary School in Wheaton, Maryland, and they had, for some reason I've never explored, and maybe I should, they had probably 15 to 20 sets of twins at that one elementary school.
Really?
And so they wanted to do this thing at an assembly and have us all sing Me and My Shadow. And I remember rehearsing that and turning to my brother and saying, I don't know about you, but I'm not anybody's damn shadow.
and what did he say?
He agreed. I mean, yeah. We went separate ways at a very early age. Our parents didn't, you know, the parents of twins make a mistake when they dress them alike. They didn't. My parents didn't do that. We had a separate identity from early on. So the confusion that people had about our identity made me want to establish it even more strongly and make it more obvious how different I was from Richard.
And are you very different? Because we've certainly all read those twin studies where twins are separated and they smoke the same cigarettes, they drink the same beer, they marry the same kind of women.
We're doing the same thing. Yeah. We write together and we're both teachers. But right. I devote more time to teaching than he does. There are ways that we're different that are subtle. But there are ways that we're the same that are amazing to me. He's a separate person. He's a different person. I mean, when I see a movie, I'm not sure if he's going to like it. When I hear a joke I think is real funny, I'm not sure he'll laugh at it. When we were younger, if I heard a joke that was funny, I knew he'd laugh at it. I knew it. Mm-hmm. And as we've gotten older, you know, we've developed and gone in different ways. My writing is different. I'm more didactic. I'm more conscious of what I'm writing about. And he's more unconscious, and his work, I think, is more artistic because of that.
Novelist Robert Bausch. His new novel is called Almighty Me. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Marty. News today of the negotiations for hostage releases in Lebanon, negotiations going on in Europe. Also, a talk with Patrick Seal, biographer of Syria's President Hafez Assad, on the politics of hostage releases in the Middle East. We'll also be hearing about the case for banking reform in light of yet another huge bank merger today. Story about a building in San Jose, California that's been a hotspot for brain cancer. Great many people, more than one might expect, contracting cancer who work there. And also a story about a cake that's supposed to never fail, but seems to always fail.
Okay. Thank you, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our jazz critic, Kevin Whitehead, says that in the time he's worked for Fresh Air, he's gotten some of his best feedback from his father, who always lets him know what he likes and dislikes about his reviews. Kevin says that his dad points out that he mentions Thelonious Monk way too often and that he doesn't review enough solo piano music. So, Chuck Whitehead, this one's for you.
Dave McKenna likes to call himself a barroom piano player, a description which is both self-deprecating and accurate. He's got tons more talent than your average cocktail lounge noodler, but the kind of music he plays does work in that sort of functional setting. When he comes to New York, his regular gig is at a Chinese restaurant. Playing in places like that is tricky. The conscientious barroom pianist has to be inobtrusive enough to stay out of the way of conversation, but also has to satisfy any jazz fan who wanders into the joint. When Dave McKenna plays live, he amuses himself and his audience by stringing together long medleys of tunes with related titles. His new album, Shadows and Dreams, for the Concord Jazz label, is made up of individual pieces recorded in the studio, but it's organized like one of those live sets. All the compositions he plays, most of them from the standard repertoire, have the word shadow or dream in their titles. Now, granted, shadows and dreams aren't the same thing, but he unites those twin motifs by playing two love songs from Rodgers and Hammerstein's The King and I, I Have Dreamed and We Kiss in a Shadow. One nice thing about a set like this is the pleasure you can take in identifying the tunes McKenna strikes up. That is, if you're up on your classic American songs. That's I'll See You in My Dreams. Dave McKenna rarely wanders very far from the melodies of these compositions. The jazz content comes mostly from the ways he treats them rhythmically. Often what's most interesting about McKenna is not what he does with his right hand, the melodic stuff, but the varied bass and rhythm patterns he plays with his left hand. Sometimes he plays steady chords, imitating the strumming of a rhythm guitar. That technique is closely associated with Errol Garner, but with McKenna, the effect is different. The way he juggles the beat between hands suggests the buoyant style known as stride piano. ¶¶ McKenna also plays four beats to the bar walking bass lines that prod his hard-swinging right hand. This is not your typical happy hour piano. Here's a slice of his Me and My Shadow. McKenna's jazz may not always be the most conceptually ambitious, but it's not in the nature of barroom piano to put on airs. Still, there's something deeply satisfying in his authoritative touch at the keyboard, his discretion and taste as an improviser, and in his abiding faith in classic melody. That's why his Shadows and Dreams is bright music of real substance.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Dave McKenna's new album, Shadows and Dreams, on the Concord Jazz label. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Bob Alls, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're all watching to see if the remaining Western hostages will be released. On the next edition of Fresh Air, we talk to former hostage David Jacobson. He was held for 17 months before being released as part of an arms for hostages deal. And he has some harsh words for our current policy toward the hostages. That's next time on Fresh Air.
Explores the fallibility of witness testimony in the courts. That's Radio Times tomorrow at 10 on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Hello, I'm Joe Pumaco. The forecast for tonight, cloudy with a low of about 65 degrees and light winds, but that has not put a damper on things here at 91FM. We're still going to go ahead at 9 o'clock tonight with our Evening with the Stars, despite the clouds. Derek Pitts of the Fells Planetarium will be here to answer your questions about, the summer night sky and astronomy in general. So if you have something you'd like to ask about that topic, please feel free to call in. We'll give you the phone number later. That's tonight at 9 o'clock, right here on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Listener-supported public radio. The time, it's now 8 o'clock.
Perez de Cuellar holds talks on the hostages.
The story in this half hour of all things...